Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed. This week's episode continues a series of two special episodes where I'm joined by Jesse from the SFF Audio Podcast. Say hi, Jesse.
Hello.
Welcome back. It's almost as though we didn't just press stop on last episode 5 minutes ago, but that's the way it works. So, last time I sort of explained what we're doing here. We decided to do a special on time travel, and where we each pick a book to talk about time travel. And Jesse's book was a Yankee in
King Arthur's Court.
Yes, by Mark Twain. We reviewed that in depth. Well, not actually in depth, but we talked about that novel quite a bit, and also the idea in science fiction when a person ends up in a time out of time, not their own time, and the kind of things that you can do with technology and ideas, and what kind of references. We didn't go into a lot of depth that time, but we just wanted to touch on that side of science fiction stories which talk about time travel. And the other side of time travel stories, or the other main aspect in time travel, isn't where the person ends up, but more the kind of things you can do with a story when the cause, well, how would I say, when the timeline doesn't just go in a straight line and nobody can move around in that.
So when you've got a flexible chronology.
Yes, when you've got a flexible chronology, or let me put this, where at least one character knows that they are out of time and they might be able to influence something, or maybe they just want to get back to the place where they arrived from. Now, in our first book, we talked about a very simple situation. Somebody at the beginning of the book goes back through time in a magical way, totally unexplained, and then comes back to his original time and tells the story. That's the very basic one. Or someone from the future can come to the present day and then go back, you know, and see how they affected. But what we're going to do this week is we're going to talk about some novels and some different stories. I'm sure, I guess we'll touch on some movie examples as well, because that's they're very well known, about the idea of time travel itself. Lots and lots of different concepts to talk about. And I thought, hey, I know a good book which will... is a good illustration of different forms of time travel or different ideas about time travel, and that is Isaac Asimov's The End of Eternity. Do you know, this is the first Asimov story I think that I have reviewed on the SFBLP.
Really?
Yeah, because what happens is that I pretty much read most of Isaac Asimov's novels back well before I started this podcast. So it gets to the point where people say, oh, how about you read this? And I'm like, oh, I've read that. How about you read this? Oh, I've read that. You know, that's happened with a lot of Arthur C. Clarke novels and quite a few Heinlein, although there has been more Heinlein. I sort of had more reason to revisit Heinlein for, you know, different discussions in the past. But yeah, I think the only Isaac Asimov novel I reviewed so far was Nightfall, which was sort of rewritten, the edited version, which was had extra bits rewritten by Robert Silverberg, which you'd think Robert Silverberg, great author, you know, Isaac Asimov, very, very, very interesting author.
It's not a good story. If you read the short story, it's fine. It's a fine idea. It's just not...
I talked about this at the time, yeah, that Nightfall is a good short story because it's told in real time, and it makes sense when you tell it in real time, because at the end of the hour it takes to read the short story, that is it going to go dark or is it not going to go dark? And that's the question. Of course, it does go dark and then all hell breaks loose, whereas Nightfall, the long... I don't want to review that. Anyway, so let's bring it back to this. Asimov... say what you like about his writing and about his characters or something, he has ideas to spare.
He does.
In this novel, he probably... You open the Wikipedia page. I'm going to open the Wikipedia page. It doesn't fit into his... It says here, they're going, the themes are very different from most of his robot or space opera stories. It's not part of any Foundation series or robot series or anything like that. It doesn't have any recurring characters from any other novel that I... know of that I can.
And you know, this is the first time I read it.
Yeah. Really?
I thought I had read all the Asimov, you know, the fiction that is, and
I guess it stands outside of his normal.
It sounds stuff. Like one I had read. I had never read it before.
Yeah. So it's not part of his, you know, Foundation or Empire or that kind of stuff. So it stands outside of that, and it's like he said, okay, what can I write? You know, what clever idea can I use in time travel which hasn't been used before. And you think, well, even by the time this was written in 1950-something, most of the ideas had sort of been written about. You know, you have all these different ideas, but he was just like, okay, I'm pretty much going to write a story which includes all these ideas and some new ones on top of that where people probably haven't come. I mean, this is the first time you've read this. I mean, were there new ideas about time travel that you've not read about in this novel?
Well, it's possible that they were in subsequent stuff that I read, you know, things that came out since 1955. But I can't say that there's one idea in here that was totally new, but it certainly encompasses a lot of the different possibilities of this sort of niche. And I think this is a very good book to pick because of that. It does, you know, a lot of the loops. It does a lot of there's barriers and logical chains, all the things that you can sort of pretty much do. You know, are you your own grandpa? You know, that sort of thing. It's all sort of in there in this. And we've seen, you know, there's a Poole Anderson series that probably is about contemporary, about the Time Corps, and it's kind of similar to this one, but this one is a lot more focused on one guy and his experience in this sort of bureaucracy.
Yeah,
it felt like a bureaucratic sort of story.
Yeah,
you know,
procedural
the story
kind
of
thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's just set this up. We're not going to go into the story about this because we were just talking about this. A story of Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. Very, very basic. Yeah, one guy goes back in time, does stuff, comes back. Here, it's a lot more complicated. So I don't want to get into any story. Not because I don't want to spoil it, just because you pretty much have to read the entire novel to understand how the entire novel works. But let's just talk about how the world is set up and some of the rules as we know them kind of at the beginning of the book, like, because even said you said in the last podcast that even the characters who are taking part in this don't really understand how time travel works at all.
That's right.
So as people understand it in the book, say at least up until even until the end, you know, some of the characters know this, but the reader doesn't know all of this. But the way it works is this: at some point time travel is discovered. And it's not just time travel is discovered, but this time field is discovered. And what happens is they create a kind of a physical space outside of normal space and time, which exists as kind of an eternal kind of thing, and it's called eternity.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it works, I mean, it's explained as you go through the book, but how it is powered, and this is something I really loved about this book, is that eternity is powered because it takes up so much power to keep a wormhole open where people can live inside of it and work inside of it and travel through time inside of it. What they do is they create a tiny little wormhole all the way until the sun goes supernova. And then they use the power from the sun going supernova to power time travel throughout the billions of years it's going to be until the sun goes supernova, which I think is a really, really fun little thing. If time travel exists, where do you get the energy from? Because time travel takes up a lot of energy to make it work. Well, you can actually get your energy for time travel anywhere where you can time travel to.
Right, which makes sense. And that's the best place to get it from because there's not going to be anybody around to suffer from it.
The sun goes nova. Well, we'll just take the power of the sun going over. So that's one of the first... I mean, you get that quite early on in the novel, but that's one of the first ideas where you just go, oh, right, okay, Asimov is like way more steps ahead of most science fiction and most science fiction writers in this point. It's like, where'd you get the energy from? He's already got that sorted, you know. But it's really fun that he puts those little bits in, but because he works out some of the logic of where do you get the energy from and where do you get this and how does this little thing, he supplies answers to quite a lot of things which normal time travel stories don't address, and then he leaves other ones unanswered. He just goes, oh, nobody knows the answer to that. But you're like, ah, oh, yeah, but he does really, even though he probably doesn't really. And it's in the same way that when H.G. Wells first wrote about the time travel machine, his was the first machine which somebody could go, right, I want to travel back to this time, not any other time, just at this time, and I want to arrive then, and I want to go at this speed. You know, he actually wrote, he built like a physical device to do that. And of course, it was totally unexplained. But he just says, when stuff is moving through time, not at one second per second, it's It's ephemeral. It's it doesn't take up any physical space because it's traveling through another dimension. So it's like if something, you know, it only occupies a space for, you know, a fraction of 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 a second. So it's like it's not even there. So if somebody arrives at the same spot as it's traveling through time, it doesn't really get in the way. And H.G. Wells explaining that for the first time, pretty much since then, nobody else has had to sort of say that. He's like, oh, that's the way it works, you know, because it doesn't take up that much space. And then everyone since then with time travel has just been like, oh, okay, yes, let's go for it. Well, I'll take that explanation as well. It only takes up a tiny fraction of physical space in the time. You know, you understand what I mean? It's spread out.
I do, yeah.
And that's even what it says in this book as well. When you're traveling up and down through time or forward and backward through time in eternity, and the geometry is kind of broke my brain in that way. You get into this lift or this elevator kind of thing.
Kind of kettle.
It's called a kettle, and you travel through, but lots of other people can be using the same elevator shaft at the same time. As long as they're not stopped at the same point as you, it doesn't really matter. So
it's, you know, in the Ray Bradbury story, the butterfly one, what's that called? Not a gun for dinosaur, but, you know, they travel through time and they go back, and halfway on their journey backwards, they feel a bump in time. They say, oh, that we just passed ourselves coming forward.
Yeah. Exactly. It's that same kind of thing. It's like, okay, we don't have to worry about things being in the same place as each other, as long as they're not in the same place as each other for
at the same time.
At the same time. But not just at the same time, but at a rate of 1 second per second. Because if something's traveling faster than something else through time, it doesn't get in the way physically in real space. Again, it's one of these kind of brain-crunching things. So, I don't even know how to explain the next step of this. So, what happens is, once eternity is established, what they start doing is they start going forward in time and finding materials, and they start trading, and then over time they start working out, us people here in eternity can change stuff outside of eternity, but us as people here in eternity continue on as before.
Yeah, they age at a regular rate.
Yes.
But they can go to any time period and fiddle around with things. And
yeah,
they seem to have a sort of a governmental role. You know, they're sort of the rulers of all time, except they don't rule as much as they sort of maintain.
Yeah, but it's also a little bit like, you know, like the Adjustment Bureau or the Adjustment Squad or whatever the original story was by, is it Philip K. Dick? And in that story, it's like these people who exist outside of time and they have stuff planned out, and it's like, you two people can't meet. Because if you do meet, bad things are going to happen, not just to you two, but to the world. And that's what the Eternity's function becomes, is that they want to make it so the physical world, the world outside of Eternity, can get by without any wars and without any genocides and without any tyranny and without any of this and without any of that. And everyone's going to be happy and everyone's going to be cool about it. And yet they're trying to be a non-tyranny. They've got so much power, but they're using this power in a beneficial way for everybody outside of eternity. Is that right? Am I getting this right?
That sounds about right. It seems that their mission is to try and smooth things out so that the most disastrous things don't befall the human species as a whole. So individual problems, as long as they don't affect eternity, are... there are small tragedies that are not worth fixing, but you know, if somebody's going to arise and cause some global catastrophe, they've got to nip that in the bud and smooth things over and make things nice and neat. And what's nice is it's set up early on, and then it pays off in an unusual and unexpected way later on in the book. We get revelations, and that's exactly what I want from a good science fiction time travel story. We don't see that in Connecticut Yankee. Basically, history goes back to the way it was, right?
Yeah, but move on to that point in a minute. But what I'm trying to say is that once they change something in the real world, the people in eternity remember how it was before they changed it.
That's right. So only in eternity, though.
Only in it, and this is one of the things which I think this book does well, or in an interesting way compared to other books. There's lots of times where someone will go through time, change something, and then come back to the modern day, and everything's changed, and yet they somehow remember how it was. You know, like Back to the Future is a great example of this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Change something, and then he comes back, and it's like, well, how does he know what was different? You know, how, you know, because he set up a different loop. Nobody ever knows that. They have to be in eternity to do this. So you, when you change something, it actually sets up a whole new reality. Reality changes a lot, and then but the people do remember it. So also what eternity is, the function of eternity, is to remember the works of culture and the works of art and the scientific advances of the reality which no longer exists. And that's what I really like about this. It's sort of like, okay, there's now an alternative reality compared to what it was. But don't worry, we've got this. We've got the works of Shakespeare of its time over here preserved. Oh, reality has changed again. Well, let's get another version of, you know, the Shakespeare of its time now. Oh, and another one. I think at one point it says
That could be expanded into a whole other book. And yeah, it's very lightly touched upon here.
Yeah, but it says we've got now 13 different versions of what the complete works of Shakespeare would be if time had changed over there, and there's whole, you know, he says there's whole like universes dedicated and whole papers and careers made about analyzing the differences in between the two documents of this, you know, of these plays or of these books or whatever it was. So that is a
inspired aspect of the book. I mean, there's a lot of this is just Asimov doing his mind, you know, showing the flexibility and incredibly insightful of his mind, but that sort of that element and sort of the background, I think, is you know, he was an academic.
Yeah.
This is professorial jockeying and what is a worthy area of study and are we going to get a grant for that? That all that stuff is sort of the structure of this the Eternals. You know, the that's the target.
Yeah, yeah,
and it's not sort of lampooned as much as it's we got all these issues and yet we do all this great work as well.
Yeah, but also I really like about that is that this someone actually sent me an email about this. It said, "Oh, you're doing End of Eternity. Did you know that the End of Eternity used to have a different ending, or there's two different endings to it, or there's two different versions of it?" And I think that's really funny that I didn't know that. I was just like, oh, there's just this, you know, we got this and that's it. And I don't know, there's different translations will have different versions of it and things, but I didn't know that. And I can't find any information on, well, I tell you, haven't really looked for any different information online about the different endings or what was the original ending or what was the changed ending or if the version that we listened to as an audiobook was the original or changed version. But I think it's funny that both versions out there will exist, and that's kind of
you have to be outside of time to get to
to both of them, which is a quite funny thing. And that's actually what we're going to bring up when we were just chatting before we recorded the last podcast, was that, hey, we've been reading a different version of King Arthur's Court, Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court, and that's what we have here as well. So which is the real version? You know, is it the first one, or is it the later one where, you know, Isaac Asimov has come back into the story from outside of the inside of eternity and the reality and changed it again, and now which one's the real one? I mean, you could write a doctorate on that issue as well. Anyway, so that's another thing. So what else? Oh, yeah, this is what you say. The malleability of reality through time travel, or the eternity's fiddling with reality, is limited. It doesn't matter how big of a change you make when you do something, it only lasts for a certain amount of time. So if you make a very, 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 very small change, it'll only last for maybe 2 days, and then history will revert back to what it was. Somehow history will go back into will put itself back.
Yeah, the trends and forces are tendencies that you don't have to. It makes it so that you don't have the butterfly effect, basically.
No. You do for a very limited time, but not for like long swathes of time. Like if I change something now, in 1,000 years, probably won't have had any effect. And that's what I really like about this kind of idea. Again, it's not what he does. It's not unique to him in his telling of it. Like the inertia, that's the kind of thing that I like to talk about there. The inertia of history. How much change can one man really make? You know, if he tries to make a really, 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 really big change, like kill Hitler or something, sure, that'll have a big, big impact. But killing Hitler, will 500 years be any different after you killed Hitler? Maybe 1,000 years, in 1,000 years' time? will 1,000 years be any different for that? You know, it's sort of like, say,
good questions, hard to know the answers.
Pick a historical figure, but that's the kind of thing. It's like, okay, in England, William the Conqueror killed Harold Godwinson by an arrow to the eye. Very, very famous death of one person. If we'd have changed that, would the United Kingdom be any different? Yeah, probably. And that would have had this rippling effect. But imagine just one other person in that battle dying. Probably, you know, dying or not dying, probably wouldn't have had a big effect, you know. Maybe. I don't know. And that's what I really like about this novel.
Genghis Khan, right? One-fifth of all Asians are related to him.
Yes, right? Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah. You nip him in the bud, things might look a lot different.
Yeah, borders but just one of his guys that he's working with. But fast forward 1,000,000 years into the future, will he have anything be different? Because that's what they do. It's sort of like this story is set over like about just over 1,000,000 years of real time, eternity. They talk about, oh, he's in this century. He's in the,
11,000s or whatever.
Yeah, he's in the 750,000. No, not that high. No, because they do it by centuries, don't they? So, yeah, the 700th century or whatever. You stick another few zeros on that and you get 1,000,000 years by the end of it. So the different centuries pretty much stay rigid to their own mores, their own kind of culture, their own level of technology. I like it how some of them are energy centuries and some of them are this. And I really like, at this point, we can actually... Yeah, just to talk about it, like when you change something, it slowly gets back on time, which means bigger the change. Oh, no, I mentioned that already. Bigger the change, the longer it takes to get back on time again. So really, you only want to make changes which will last for the next few centuries, because then they can be computed out by the computers. There's a whole load of people called the computers.
I don't know if you probably didn't, but to me, I thought they were actually computers. Like, I thought it was an AI at first, and then I realized, no, that's just the job title.
Yeah,
oh, yeah, okay,
the job
sense
the job title was computer, because back in 1955, a computer was somebody that computed. There wasn't computing machines. Well, I guess there was basic computing machines.
In the 30s, there was a job, you could apply for, either secretary, computer,
Your job was
foundry,
to sit in a...
Foundryman.
Yeah,
right?
Your job was to sit there and do sums. And here, the computers are the in eternity, let me put it this way, the computers are the most important people, because they're the ones who kind of, okay, if you make this change, I'm going to compute what will... It will be a beneficial effect or not a beneficial effect, and how long the effect will take. And our main character is, he's a technician, isn't he? So he goes through time and he's the guy who makes the changes, and he's shunned, and I really like this, he's shunned because he is the one who's actually making the change. He is the person who people go, oh.
He's low man on the totem pole, and that's sort of more in with the academic. Yeah, they look at his shoulder patch and say, oh, you're one of those, I won't even look at you.
No, but it's not just about that.
You're the maintenance man.
No, he's not the maintenance, because maintenance. He's the technician. He is he's not looked down on, but he's shunned by the rest of the people in eternity, because he is the one who's actually physically changing the world, and therefore negating entire centuries of people, changing people's lives, killing off this person, making all these people not exist and these people to exist, and changing the balance, even though everything he does is for the overall betterment of the human race. Because he's the one who's actually changing something, he is the one who is let me have a look here on the Wikipedia.
That sounds right.
Oh, yeah, I guess. They feel an unspoken collective guilt which causes them to scapegoat the technicians, the expert who actually execute reality changes by doing something that will alter the flow of events. I mean, it says there in Wikipedia, so it must be true. So, yeah, the technician...
No, I think that's right.
So, and I actually really like this, that even though all the Eternals are doing something, even though everyone there knows that they're outside of time and that their actions aren't really going to influence their lives in any way, and it is very much a caste system. Like, oh, the technician isn't low. He's sort of like outside of the caste system, but shunned. And the computers are the high, the most important one. You got the observers, you got the all these other ones. And then you got not the slave labor, but you get the people who normally live in reality, and they come in and supply eternity at the different points through it as well. What else do we want to talk about? I like that kind of idea of the inertia of time. Actually, in the novel that you've still not read that I wrote called Minding Tomorrow, there is a bit of the inertia of time going on there.
I'm waiting for the audiobook.
The audiobook might not ever happen. Just read the read the fucking book. It's an ebook. It's free. Just read it one time. It only takes a few hours to read.
All right.
You can do it. You can do it. You'll like it. It's very good.
I hope so.
Anyway, there is a little bit of that going on there. I don't think I'm spoiling too much.
Let me tell you one of the cool things that I like that's in this book that is in a lot of time travel things. Yep. That is when you say you're having a conversation with somebody, we can time travel. Therefore, if I set my mind to time traveling, to doing something, I can make something happen in this reality without actually having done it yet. Right. So.
Oh yeah, I like that. Yeah.
The most succinct scene of this I've ever seen is actually in a really terribly funny and stupid movie, and that is Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Yeah, you've seen that movie?
Yeah, of course. That was the example that I was going to do. They do this exactly. It's like, all we need to do now is to decide to put our car keys on that mantelpiece. That means we can just pick them up now, and there they are. Right. Look, there they are. Yeah.
Yeah, well, no, they'd be. So I think they're in an alley or something. He says, well, right now, the only thing that would stop those guys is a machine gun. Luckily, I know that I can go back in time and get a machine gun. And therefore, I would have put a machine gun in this garbage can. And he takes the lid off and there's a machine gun in there, right? It just solved all the problems, right?
Yeah.
And it's a perfect little logic thing. It's follow the consequences of that possibility.
Yeah, and that's what happens here. They make a change. They're going, okay, eternity, blah, blah, blah. Somebody has made a change in the past. But because time travels in eternity is slightly different, it's like we only have the amount of time it'll take now for, let me try and work this out, for the person who's going to change something in the past to decide to change something in the past. Once the person in the past decides to change something, that's when we're going to see the effect.
That sounds about right.
And it's like, and it's that kind of decision, it's that moment of saying, oh, I know, I am 100% going to change something. And if there's ever a higher probability that they won't change it, then they will change it. The change doesn't happen until they decide or do something to change it. And that's when it sets up the sort of like a bit of a race against time at the end. It's like, we've got to get to this person before he changes his mind. Hopefully I'm not giving away too much about the book there. But again, that's the kind of thing. So how about in that novel, it's like, oh, that person's going to have a machine gun unless I kill them before they remember or work out that they have to have a machine gun down that alley.
I don't think it was a machine gun, but it was something to that effect, you know?
Yeah, I know.
Where you just need this essential one piece of technology or whatever, and it solves it.
I really like that.
Following the necessary chain of thinking in time travel is what makes this kind of time travel story so interesting, right? Because in a way, I feel like the main character, Harlan, is a bit of a dim bulb when it comes to following the logic chain, because I'm like way ahead of him in many cases, but that's because I've read all these stories.
Yeah,
right?
But also he's way ahead of you in many other cases. I think because he picks out some stuff that you just won't pick up on, but you sort of do pick up on. But he's like ahead of you, and then he kind of explains stuff and makes some decisions about that. Yeah, no, I do like that. But this is definitely, like I say, it's a novel. How do I put this? So in a lot of novels, someone will travel to the future just by falling asleep. And that's very easy. You know, put someone in cold sleep, you know, Demolition Man. The reason why someone from the present going into the future is interesting because the person in the present has skills that the people in the future don't have. And that's why they wake them up again in the future to do that kind of stuff. You know, Demolition Man is great. There's a threat there, and only someone from the end of the 20th century can sort that out by, again, dynamite and blowing shit up to bring it back to that. So that's cool. But you know, the people of the time know that time travel can work, but because it's only, you know, it's not outside of their experience. This is a End of Eternity is a novel where everybody knows that time travel can work and does happen, and people go through time. Everybody in Eternity knows all the rules and what can happen in that way and all that kind of thing. And everyone outside of Eternity also knows that people are traveling through Eternity and we can communicate with different centuries, but we're happy in this century and things like that. And so what you actually get is discussions between people in the novel about time travel. That doesn't often happen. Well, it can happen, but normally it's just like, oh, well, we don't know this, because it's like, often time travel is a secret, in the same way that in lots of fantasy novels, especially ones set in the modern day, that magic exists is a secret, and not everybody knows that magic exists, that zombies exist, or that vampires exist, is a secret. And it's very often that, certainly at the beginning of a story, people don't know that time travel can work or can exist, because if everybody did know that time travel could exist, how would they respond to that? So, of course, in Back to the Future, you know, it's someone coming up with a machine that time travel can exist. In the Accidental Time Machine, someone comes up with a time travel machine that nobody else knows exists, and when he goes to the future, then people do know he exists. And you get this time and time again that when the big story begins, people in the story, the wider world, don't know that time travel can exist and that, you know, all these problems will arise. In this novel, everybody knows that time travel can exist.
Yeah, after a certain point, though, right? So I guess that after the end of the 20th century.
Yeah, yeah. Once time travel is invented, everybody knows it. But yeah, it's set in the future. Yeah. However, what I want to bring in now, what this book does, and this is the thing that I think is interesting about this, and how many different ways this talks about time travel in a way that other science fiction books don't do on such a... On such a self-aware kind of basis, is that in this book, the people in Eternity know that reality outside is mutable, and that they are changing everyone, and that somebody's life can change, and that that they'll remember what it was like before and after. People outside of Eternity don't know that. They think that their reality is like it is, and it always has been like it is, and there's no reason to think that the people in Eternity are doing anything different. You know, they don't understand the full impact of that, and they misunderstand it. They think the people in Eternity just live forever.
They live forever,
yeah,
that's right.
They think that's what they do. If you can get into Eternity, that's the good thing about Eternity. And so you actually get two sets of people, one set of people who knows everything that you need to know about time travel and about the grandfather paradox and about this and about that, and no, we can't go back in time because everything in Eternity is strange, and if you go out you can take this little device with you which sets you in a little bubble so it doesn't affect you if you do change something, that you don't get changed along with that. But everybody outside doesn't understand the full extent of the malleability of time, and that actually what they are now living in is not the probability one future. How do I say that? If nobody had done any time travel changes, and probability would work out that's
regular reality.
Yeah, regular unmanipulated reality. Everybody just thinks that they're in unmanipulated reality because everything in the past leads up to this. I mean, this is, we're getting into quite tricky stuff to get your head around, but what I like about End of Eternity is that you actually get both of these ideas being presented alongside each other, and people in the book presenting these ideas alongside each other and then having a discussion about them, but not just a discussion about them, but actually using them for plot purposes.
So, you know, there's a whole sort of branch off of time travel that is more related to this kind of time travel than the Man Out of time travel, and that's alternate history. Sidewise in Time. There's a story called Sidewise in Time by Murray Leinster.
Yeah, it's where you go to another
invented
thread. Yeah.
That's right. So in this one, we've got a concurrent reality that is manipulable, but also tends towards back the mainstream, so that you have to go in and fix things individually in individual centuries. If you read like the later Heinlein novels that deal with sort of alternate universes or multiple universes, there is a feeling after reading a bunch of these that nothing matters because anything is possible. Anybody who dies can be brought back to life, and it becomes basically completely useless and uninteresting after a certain point. After you sort of understand what can be done in these universes, which is anything. When anything can be done, it's boring, I think, and it becomes sort of masturbatory in an uninteresting way.
Yeah, but not like Groundhog Day, where he's going...
No,
That's a different thing as well. That's a different thing again. So,
but
let me bring this back to it, that the whole idea...
This book doesn't do that, right?
No, it does. It does.
It does, but it also has a plot that doesn't just meander. It feels like it's meandering, but there's actually something happening that is revealed.
It's a bigger picture at the end.
That's right. There's a bigger picture, and I think that he's sort of he's navigated this sort of twisty problem.
Are you going to give away the problem? Shall I do it?
I don't want to.
But let me just say that if, like I've been saying, that every idea of time travel that we're bringing up, both sides of that problem are being presented and talked about and used for plot purposes in this book. So even if you say, there's only one history and it always stays there, you know, and there's other one which always does this, and then we find out later on that actually there's a lot more going on here than we ever imagined. But that's sort of like being revealed way, way, way down the book. So I don't want to go into too much of it there. Mm-hmm. But no, I do understand what you mean about like the picking. If like this is a reality and there's another reality and there's another reality and there's another reality, what makes this reality special? And if any decision that I make, if there's another me in a different place, there's what matters there. Again, I could talk
about infinite universes is really. It means nothing. It's completely useless.
Yeah.
Because however,
however, I do like the idea of some of that. You know, if a story is told well, like, and it's used for story purposes, but you like I say, it doesn't become interesting in its own right. You know, in its own. If it's a story about infinite, like the person going through infinite things, it's difficult to make that interesting.
I've not seen it done beautifully. But, you know.
You should read Minding tomorrow.
All right, I will check that out.
Oh no, you know, I'm giving away too much. Oh no, spoilers.
Don't worry, I'll forget. But you know, we talked about a few movies and little scenes in movies. I think my favorite time travel story is By His Bootstraps by Robert A. Heinlein. Do you know that one?
Yeah, the thing is, I would get it mixed up with all of the other Heinlein time travel stories. I'm not quite sure.
There's two main ones that he's done. One is called By His Bootstraps. That's about a graduate student working on his thesis who receives a visit from himself.
It. Yeah, yeah, that's it.
And then there's another one called All You Zombies. Which
that's the one I'm thinking of as well.
Right? Yeah. And that's not quite as good, although it's more of a joke. By His Straps is interesting because he's working on a thesis about time travel, can't finish it, and then gets help from himself who shows him how to travel through time, and then he has to doesn't realize who he is, blah, blah, blah. Great little story about, you know, finding that full circle thread all the way through, you know, making a knot out of your own timeline.
Yeah. Should we talk about that in this book as well, in End of Eternity?
Yeah, because that's that happened.
Yeah, no, it does happen. That's what I'm saying. Like, even all these different things, it's like if the grandfather paradox, like how can you do something which becomes a loop? Is something which is a loop in time. It only exists like an idea, and it works really nicely because you get these ideas of, okay, if there's an idea, what if, I know there's a story like this, so if when someone goes back and gives Shakespeare the complete works of Shakespeare, and Shakespeare then writes out stuff from the complete works of Shakespeare, so in other words, nobody has ever written the complete works of Shakespeare.
Yeah, it was never created.
It was never created.
It has no source or mother.
And this happens time and time again through these things. Like, how does time travel exist? Well, the way that time travel exists is that someone from the future came back and told us how to do time travel. Oh, and how did that work? Well, that's how it works there as well. And we get this time and time and time and time again through time travel stories, and even in End of Eternity that is sort of like referenced there as well. But I really like the idea of sending an idea or a physical object through into the past. Is that the grandfather paradox, where that's something different, isn't it? It's like if that's about changing the time, whereas in the continuous time loop to make a loop and close the loop, which is quite a big part of the plot in End of Eternity at one point.
So in a way, the physical object is much harder to explain, even if it's a, you know, something that isn't likely to decay or anything. You know, you've got a stainless steel, I don't know, whatever it is, and you send that back in time. You know, the guy who reaches into his pocket and pulls out a pocket watch that he was given by his grandfather, it was really him. Where did that watch, where was it manufactured? No way to know. Right. And sort of that's the point of that story.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's an idea, right, I'm going to go back and give the idea of liberation to women to the women's movement. Then it almost seems like that could be possible, except it still has this who thought it up first. Right.
Yeah.
And then you say, okay. Well, it makes you think those thoughts.
Again, you should read Minding tomorrow.
All right.
I should just do it. No.
All right.
Okay, I'm just saying about that. It's not sending a thing back in into the past, which revolves, and it's not sending just an idea. There's more to it than that, which I like to think that with Minding Tomorrow, I've not solved all these problems, but I've approached these problems in a way that I haven't seen anyone else do in science fiction. And people have said, oh, that book, your novel is a bit like this or a bit like that. But I thought I came up with a fun way of explaining these different, you know, some of these different time travel-y kind of things in ways which haven't been done before. Again, I don't think I'm spoiling too much about saying that it is a time travel story, which is about lots of different things. I mean, there's lots of stuff going on there, but it is quite short, and I do think it does present some ideas which haven't.
Can I get an audiobook made out of?
We'll put
it on the SFF audio podcast.
It's difficult.
Okay?
Again, too difficult to do an audiobook of it for someone like me. Just read it.
We'll see if we can find a narrator.
Anyway, but what I'm saying is, in that book, there is the idea of sending things back in time. To yourself, there are ideas of multiple timelines. There are ideas of the which makes multiple timelines difficult. And I, like you said before, it's very difficult to come up with something where it doesn't really matter if I die in this timeline because I'll go into another timeline. It doesn't matter if I do this or do that, mm-hmm. And there's actually somebody trying not to change things in timelines to be able to do stuff in the future. And the difficulties involved there. And there's another two or three sort of major elements in there as well. Oh, yeah, and the cost of it as well. Like, how much does it cost to do time travel? For me, is a very, very important thing in time travel novels. If it's too easy, why hasn't everyone done it? If it's too simple, why hasn't everyone done it? And if people have been able to crack the way of doing time travel in the future, how have they not come back and told us about it? That's one of those other paradoxes. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the grandfather paradox. If that's possible, then it's not possible. And that's the way it shakes out so many times. You know, time travel does exist, but nobody is allowed to know about time travel, because if anyone ever finds out that time travel does exist, time travel then can't exist, because the world will make it so it can't exist unless it's kept as a secret. And that's something that happens over and over again in science fiction novels as well. It has to be a secret for it to exist.
Did you hear a couple years ago they tried to hold a time travelers convention?
Mm-hmm.
People show up, you know, did you see them open a portal? How did they get through? You know,
yeah.
Is a clever idea. And Boing Boing, I think, had a picture up last year or the year before in which they had a what looked like a man out of time in the 1930s. He's wearing sort of cool sunglasses and looks like he's got an iPod or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, finding the anachronisms that.
Yeah, that, there was that one where someone found a picture of someone going into a movie and they have a mobile phone and they're talking to a mobile phone.
That's right.
As well. It was a hearing aid. Back before hearing aids fit in your ear, there were these big chunky things that you held beside your ear, like a modern mobile phone.
The trumpet.
Back at the juggling convention back in 2003, the European Juggling Convention, you know, maybe 2,500 jugglers there, and lots of people do workshops, and they put up on a big board about where the workshop will be, what it's about, who will be doing the workshop, and then hundreds of people sometimes turn up, or maybe 10 people, sometimes hundreds of people turn up to do a workshop. And I thought, we've got this whole week's worth of workshops going on there. And so I decided to write down advanced time travel Wednesday, 1 o'clock in the afternoon in this place. And then later on, I put beginner's time travel. time travel number two, advanced time travel techniques on Wednesday. And then on Friday, time travel number one, beginner's time travel. And then I think at the same time that I did, that I put that workshop down, the workshop number one, which was the later workshop, I also put down Paradoxes for Beginners by me in a venue like just nearby or something like that. And people actually turned up to that time travel. And I was like, no, it was just a joke. But it was one of those funny things that you could do with different time travels. So, what else is that? What else is there going on here as well in this book? We have the time travel stuff. We got the immutability. We've covered quite a lot of subjects that were in this novel. Mm-hmm. Any other things about time travel? Hmm. Maybe I should open up the Wikipedia page of time travel and let's go through some of these. So
we've sort of covered it. I wondered about. I'm always trying to find out what the background things are. Do you think that there's that the guy being named Harlan has anything to do with Harlan Ellison. Is Harlan Ellison got a time travel story that I don't know about that
somehow to be honest, fits into this? I've never read very much Harlan Ellison. Everything of his that I have read, I've not been that impressed by. And just as a person and a character, nothing about him has ever made me want to read any more of his fiction than I ever have. So I just really don't care. Although when his name is Harlan, it comes in. It's like it would have been like if Harlan Ellison wrote a story about someone like called Asimov or something, which does happen. You know, science fiction authors are referenced in other science fiction. There was someone called someone Sagan in a novel. What was that? I can't remember. Old Man's War. In there, they named the nameless people after, you know, people that the author was a fan of. Although I can't remember the name of the author now.
There is an Asimov novel that I've read and maybe even reviewed called Murder at the ABA. It's a murder mystery by Asimov in which there's a detective who is very Asimovian, and there's a murder victim called Darius Dust, as in Darius as dust.
Yeah,
right? Darius Dust. And there's some like ribbing between Harlan Ellison and one of them is an analog for Harlan Ellison, and the other is a Asimovian character.
Well, so. I guess Asimov did. Was it Asimov or Heinlein? No, who did the Black Widow stories about the Black Widow?
That's Asimov.
That's Asimov, yeah, as well. So I guess that they do reference each other in the fiction, but maybe is Harlan Ellison sexist and bigoted? I mean, it's that kind of thing.
No, I don't Harlan, think so. I think
Harlan in the book is quite a nasty kind of guy, especially towards women. He really, because he comes from, and again, it is a plot point how sexist he is, because
it's kind of funny, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of like who's this guy? And then he's like, oh yeah, and again, I don't want to spoil it too much, but there's a reason why he is quite nasty towards women, and it is a plot point, but he's picked
well. It's also it's built into their structure, right? The Time Corps or whatever they're called, the Eternals, they don't have women. Generally they're not suitable.
That's another thing as well, I didn't mention that. The people who go in eternity, it's only people who can be removed from eternity removed from reality without upsetting reality too much in the years in the future. Those people can be removed and work in eternity. And it's like this weird reverse, a reverse sexism in a way, is that they think, oh, men are better than women. It actually turns out, no, the most effectual people on history, the people who really influence history the most, are the women. It's 10 times more likely for a man to not have any effect in the world than for a woman to have no effect in the world. And I was like, yeah, of course, because who is the biggest impact on someone when they're originally born and growing up? It's the mother. Who makes all the decisions about the child? Pretty much the mother. It doesn't, in the end, doesn't matter too much who the father is. It's the mother who makes that big difference to somebody in terms of how much impact they're going to have later in their life. Not always, but I just read a silly story about, the Obamas went to a small restaurant, and the cook said to the special service, oh, can I talk to Michelle Obama? And they went off, had a chat, and they came back, and Barack Obama was like, who was that? And Michelle was like, oh, you know, when we were 15, he was in love with me. And and Obama said, if you'd gone up and married him, maybe you would own this restaurant now. And Michelle says, no.
He would have been president.
Yeah, he would have been president. I'm like 99.999999% sure this is just an apocryphal tale, and it's probably been told about many presidents in the past and many great men in the past. But it is one of those things. You're just like, the mother figure, the wife figure, those are the real important ones throughout time. Again, that kind of stuff is addressed here in this novel, and it's almost a throwaway line. It's like, oh yeah, everyone here is males because actually men aren't that important. And Harlan, our main character, just doesn't pick up on that. So which again brings us to that sort of like man out of time and different social aspects. He goes into different places and goes, well, I don't like it in this century because everyone, women don't give birth. They do this and do that. And another guy, well, we all chop our hair off and modify our bodies in different ways.
Or the entire place is mirror shined.
Yeah. Right?
Or what? You're still using a actual body? We have energy fields.
Yeah. We're an energy body kind of thing over here. But it's very funny that after a while, those energy bodies go back and people actually revert back. And it's like at one point they say, oh, yes, this car, people would have recognized this car because it was also popular in the 250th century, the 3047th century, the 7000th this century, and it's like, oh yeah, all the different inventions, it's just going to loop back over and over and over and over of them on time, you know, as the earth goes through different phases and gets energy from here and then uses this kind of cultural system and this kind of government, it just keeps going back over and over itself.
You know, the other thing that sort of stood out as anachronistic was he's got this massive magazine collection.
Oh, yeah.
It's like,
is what we wanted to talk about, is how do you send a message from the past to the future with nobody in between knowing it's a message from the past to the future, but then the person who you're writing it to picking out that it is a message from the past to the future. And this is a really fun little thing in this book.
Well, I also want to point out that it's hard to imagine that in 100 years, people are still going to be coveting old magazines in their physical form. The protagonist Harlan has this collection, and that's just his weirdness. But his boss is like, "Oh, I don't even know how to read these things. How do you manipulate the leaves and stuff, such?" But yeah, if Asimov had written it as, you know, a more predictive way rather than for the 1950s audience, it would be even harder to understand what's going on than it is with all these energy bodies. And right, I mean, ebooks are a lot easier to do than energy fields for your arms and your mind.
But this is the weird thing, is that they can pick any technology that's ever been invented throughout outside of eternity and use it in eternity if they want to. Yet everything they do is on punch cards, and yet other people have energy bodies. It is so strange that kind of thing. That's what you're always going to get. Nobody is going to do a good prediction of the future, which I think is, you know, in my own novel, I kind of sidestep back that and say, actually, we're all anything that happened in this time. This is what I want to do, is actually I want to go through and edit it and put proper dates on it, because so many times, you know, it was a bit cowardly to tell a story that's set in the future and have it as an indeterminate future. You know, how far advance are we? Oh, it's always next Wednesday. What's the thing, isn't it? It's always tomorrow. It's always going to be next week when this story is set. It's never going to be too close to now. And I'll just say, oh no, that hasn't happened yet. But then, as stuff happens in this series where, oh yeah, I mentioned this a few times, it's like, oh yeah, when I write about this bit of technology and it already exists now, what I need to do is actually just say, okay, the beginning of the story was in 2009 when I released the novel, and that's always going to be there, and just admit to people that this is in a future, it's not in the future. It's because it's a time travel story, so it's going to be set in a future, not the future. And I make that more explicit in the second novel, in Combat, with the stuff that happens there. It actually says at the beginning of each chapter, it says in a future, so it's not like, don't hold me to this, you know. And I think that's actually a more ballsy way of doing it, and yet a more more logical way of doing it. Actually just admitting up front, it's like, okay, I'm talking about a future, not our future, not the future, but a future. If time travel exists, I'm just talking about a future, which I think is
a lot better than a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
Yeah, well, which is another great way to sidestep stuff. Yeah. And there are different time travel stories. You know, like I said before, the Door into Summer by Heinlein, where he's talking about the future in 1970, and then from 1970 goes forward into 2010. But he's still he wrote it in 1950s, so he's got two out of date futures. But that's not really explained. Another thing by Heinlein, we talked about this as well, but All You Zombies, which I think is like I say, it's a jokiness. It's like a jokey thought experiment with that. I would suggest people read
it's two
that.
Guys in a bar. I mean, it's got the joke is right built into the way it's told.
Yeah. It's like, just read it. I think it was that there was an audiobook version or like a podcast version of it as well, I think, done for the Podio. No, what is it called? Pseudopod. Is it Pseudopod?
Oh, really? No.
They did it. They did it as one of their episodes, and it only takes half an hour to listen to, and it is one of the best time travel things that we've mentioned before. Anything else about time travel? I mean, we've really not talked too much about End of Eternity, but did you enjoy it?
Yeah, you know, I always forget how Asimov writes. It's very, his ideas are what shine to me, and he writes very clearly, but his characters aren't that, you know. There's a lot, especially in this one, there's a lot of scenes where two guys are standing somewhere talking to each other. And
yeah, but it is a bit like that. But what I'm saying
is... Did I like it? Yes, I did.
Yeah,
it isn't.
Like. It's your kind of thing. It's a book about ideas. And this is what you always like about science fiction. Is that, and this is, like I say, almost every single science fiction time travel idea that you've had. I actually just looked here on the Wikipedia page. We've done, it says rules of time travel. Single fixed history, which is self-consistent and unchangeable. I guess we've done that because that's involved in the novel. We've got history is flexible and subject to change. We've done that, and that's in this novel. Alternate timelines, yeah, we've done that, and that's kind of in this novel as well. Immutable timelines, which does not allow paradoxes. That's kind of done in this novel, but things are mutable, but it's talked about in this novel. Multiple timelines, yeah, gradual and instantaneous time travel, and that's talked about in this too, you know, how people travel through time. And also it says here as well, time travel or space time travel, I guess using relativity, that's not talked about, this is about Earth.
It's not about anything else.
And it's
really
very, very specifically only about Earth, because that will make it different. Like, if you change something
There is talk about space travel, and that's sort of a key to the subplot of something, but
the way one thing that you can look at, this is not a spoiler, I mean, there's more to it than this, and more different reasons for it, but one thing that's tricky is that if eternity can arrive anywhere in time and space, or can access anywhere in time and space for where it is up until the destruction of the sun, up until, not the destruction, but the sun going nova, it's tricky. What am I trying to say here? It's like, how far does it influence, you know, time? It takes, like, the whole light cone kind of stuff going off. This is a bit too much to get into so late on here. It's like, but if something changes something on one planet time-wise, how far can the effect go until it affects something on a different... Tell you what you should read...
I don't want to read that book. It's too big.
No. It's a big book.
17-book series that, you know, we'd fall asleep reading.
Just read House of Suns by Alistair Reynolds.
Alistair Reynolds.
It's just read that. I mean, it's such a surprising, massive twist to the end of it. I was like, holy fuck, he's actually done it. I've never read this in science fiction. And then he's actually done it. You know, how adjusting things can go from one thing. Anyway, I don't want to give it away too much, but he does something so big and so mind-bogglingly scientific, science fictional idea, which I've not seen done in another book, but have thought about myself and thought, well, this could never make it. This is too complex. This will never make it into a science fiction novel. And then he does it. Maybe I'm giving away. Actually, no, there's a lot more in that book, so it doesn't matter if I spoil one final bit. But it caught me by surprise.
No, it's not spoiling it. It's making me want to read it now.
Yeah. It's not a fantastic book, but it's Alistair Reynolds, so it's probably going to be decent. You know, it's probably going to be full of interesting stuff. Anyway, that's it for now. I think we've had two really fun discussions about time travel. Again, it's been quite brief, and if we could have done like a whole episode on just one of these different time travel things, we could have gone, right, okay, grandfather paradox, let's go. And we could have done a whole podcast just about that. But I think this has been a good kind of covering and a good way to have a look at End of Eternity by Isaac Asimov. It's a good book. I'm going to give it 3.5 stars for the ideas, and it loses quite a bit of stars for being quite a lot of two people standing in a room talking about stuff and having some characters which you actually just want to slap really hard quite often. That'll be it for me. Email me, luke@juggler.net. If you've enjoyed these or not enjoyed these, I must admit I did get an email a few days ago, which is from someone called Robert. And he says, "You and those two losers talking about Earth Abides. I tried to listen to you and Greg Mercury and that other guy discussing Earth Abides. You showed wisdom and good taste by being quiet and letting them just fucking ramble and try so desperately to show how brilliant they are." I know some people don't I like it when I get other people onto Dogger. But I know Greg is very much an acquired taste. I really enjoy listening to him because he does just bring out those batshit theories out of nowhere. He says Spinoza.
Everybody, it's amazing. Yeah, it's amazing to me. Like when we talk to Eric, you know,
yeah.
Like I can't imagine him bringing some of the stuff that he does to the table. But it's like, wow, he you know, a lot of the stuff, it's Adam and Eve, and it's yeah. fairy tales, and it's sex, and it's like, yeah. Well, that's not what I'm thinking. But
yeah, I know, and I'm and I am. And I am totally happy to call Greg and Eric on their bullshit, but I guess it doesn't go down with everyone. I guess I generally read what's in the text and don't. I mean, I do bring lots of other stuff to it, but.
But sometimes, you know, they are finding stuff that actually you got to admit. Oh my God, it is
yeah.
there.
When and Eric talks about that story of how he actually explained what the author was thinking as he thought it and said, actually, what you were doing was this. And the author was like, oh yeah, that is what I was thinking when I do it, but yeah. I didn't know until you explained it. And that actually just happened to me in the latest novella thing that I put out called Get That Rat Off My Face. Someone brought up one of the most amazingly obvious things, which was definitely in the text, which I had written and not realized. I had not acknowledged it. And he said, yeah, but it's obviously the title doesn't make sense because you talk about this and it doesn't actually mean that. And I was like, holy fuck, how did I miss that? And I'm normally the person when I'm writing, I try and put in all these little games and I put in these little thematic connections and try and put in these different characters and these different things which people can, if they want to look deeper, they can find it deeper. And he had picked out something which was so blatantly obvious on the surface, which is so blatantly obviously that something I'd put on there and yet hadn't.
Well, a part of you had put it in. See, the thing is the unconscious, it does exist.
And this was, and considering I wrote this.
It all is in there, right? Yeah. You know, Eric is not wrong when he says that we all know these stories and that they influence our thought.
Yeah,
now,
but the point is that
he can read that in and make a consistent story out of it, I think is a matter of his interpretation or your interpretation. But if it resonates with you, then it works.
But the point is, I actually wrote that pretty much from a dream that I had, and the very beginning of the book was in the dream, and the very end of the book was in the dream, and the stuff that in the middle where, and there's actually the point where two people are discussing something, and one of the people who read it was like, oh yeah, you're obviously talking about this and this and this, and I was like, of course I'm obviously talking about this, but until he pointed out to me, I hadn't realized it myself. So yes, the whole different bringing in, but I don't like to do too much of that in my reviews. I'd rather talk a bit more about the technology and the ideas, whereas Greg and Eric sort of jump to that as a jumping off point for the novel, and I think, well, that's a few levels down. Let's get actually the plot and the characters out of the way first and then see what else we can find in there, and they sort of start off from that position. Anyway, so I just thought it'd be that. Anyway, yeah, email me, luke@juggler.net. I do reply to every email, even though over the past 3 or 4 days, I've got so many emails I've not managed to get through them all. You can follow me on Twitter, check out my blog, lots of stuff going on my blog all the time, lots of photos and videos and writing and everything goes put on my blog. That's lukeburge.com/blog, or you can find the novels that I've been trying to get Jesse to read, some ebooks. If you go to lukeburge.com there, click on fiction or original fiction, you'll be able to find it straight away. Jesse, how can people find you?
Okay. Well, people can visit sffaudio.com, and there's lots of more bullshit conversations there on our podcasts.
Hey,
I think that people don't understand. We do these podcasts for ourselves, and that other people enjoy them too. It is occasionally possible.
Yeah, I really enjoy having conversations with Eric and Greg because they do make me think about bullshit stuff, and I enjoy. I enjoy.
Bullshit,
yeah,
right?
It's interesting bullshit, and I'm totally up with that. And I will always do. And if you want to know more about Greg and stuff, I did an interview with him for my Luke's Creative Podcast. You know, that's a whole other thing that I did, and that was pretty much a podcast where I picked out people that I wanted to have interesting conversations with, and then had those interesting conversations with them because it's interesting. You know, because they're interesting people, and the only way that I could make it. To be able to get away with that is to just do a podcast where it's pretty much about talking to creative people about doing creative stuff, and that's what interests me. So yeah, it's definitely for us and other people listening in, that three or four thousand people,
yeah, make your own podcast,
will download
like this
in the
one,
next,
right?
Yeah. I mean,
that's what happens. I listen to podcasts and I say, this guy is shit. I hate this guy. Yeah. I'm gonna make my own podcast.
Yeah, do it. Oh, you did? Okay. Anyway, so yeah, these episodes were going to be an SFF audio series, but you've already got too many people to talk to on that. You've got too many episodes that you recorded already, haven't you? So so these are going out now as a SFBRP episode. So that's it from Jesse and me. Thanks a lot for listening, and Jesse won't, but I'll catch you next time.
I'll be listening.
Well,